Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George. Kathleen George is a theater professor at the University of Pittsburgh, where she also earned a PhD in theater and a subsequent MFA in fiction. She is the author of two previous mysteries featuring Richard Christie. She and her husband live in Pittsburgh on the city's historic North Side. She'll be reading tonight from her latest novel, After Image, a thriller. Thanks for coming to Prosody, Kathleen.
Thank you.
How about we start tonight with some After Image?
All right. I'm going to start from a section fairly well on in the book, because it's where I take up again with Christie, who's the commander of the homicide and major crimes division of the police in Pittsburgh. And this is a case he's on. Christie was starting out for headquarters early. He liked the quiet of the office on a Sunday morning. Last night, middle of the night, he got a call. A man had been found shot dead in his backyard in Homewood. It looked like a drug deal gone bad, the patrol cop said. So Christie put a couple of men on it overnight, orchestrating from the phone beside his bed. Marina didn't get much sleep with the phone going all night, but that case was moving along fast. Four men had named the same shooter, and now the detectives could be very specific. The suspect couldn't hide forever, hopefully. The full moon had been 2 nights ago, but maybe there was some lunacy left over with these two murders in 2 days, and on a weekend, as usual. Christie left his house and took Fifth, then the Parkway. He had only an hour with his kids at the picnic. Yesterday, Marina was being decent about it, but she ended up spending much more time with his kids than he did. His hope on this Sunday morning driving to work was to get in, get everybody assigned and organized, and somehow sneak a couple of hours with Eric and Julie before they had to go back to their mother. So in his mind, and occasionally at a red light on paper, he was preparing the roster of assignments as they'd be split between the Homewood killing and the McCall killing. On the legal pad he grabbed from time to time, he put Colson and McGranahan on canvassing, Pataki on computer records, what to do with Greer. Put her on computer with Pataki, or quiz people about Laura McCall. Meanwhile, the DA was still leaning hard on the lab technicians to get backlogged evidence ready for a trial that would begin on Tuesday. Truth was, they didn't have enough analysts. They didn't have enough hours. New cases had to wait while old cases got their attention. What a mess to have the technology without the manpower. Do it the old way, Christie's inner voice said. Before DNA, footprints, analysis of all kinds, chemical tricks. The old way, that meant thinking, observing. That meant Dolan sweet-talking a confession out of someone. He was coming off the Parkway and passing Hines Field when his phone rang. Commander, it looks like a homicide. I have the patrol car on the line. Christie kept going past Hines Field, dazed. Three then, in 36 hours. He really wasn't young enough for this round-the-clock stuff. He heard the patrolman come onto the line to report the crime. Commander, we took a call this morning. A girl, was found dead in West Park. The park was only 3 blocks or so from where Christie sat at a light, the phone to his ear. How old, he asked. I can't tell. Could be 10, 11, older. I'll be right there, he said, and I mean right there. The media was going to be all over this one. The assignment sheet next to him was definitely going to change unless someone was standing by, waiting to confess. He called the desk at headquarters. Start calling the homicide detectives early, he said. Some were due at 9. He wanted all of them by 8. A dead kid meant no time with his own kids. He heaved a big sigh. Driving toward the crime scene, he called for a mobile crime unit. He felt the craziness in the air, the oppressive humidity pressing his skull, making his brain clogged, foggy. The air conditioning in his car was on high, and he could still feel the wetness in the air. He got back on with the patrol cop, even though he was only 50 yards from the site. Who called it in? Some guy walking his dog. West Park, he thought. Our Greer runs there most days. He wondered if she'd run this morning yet. You're able to keep people away? Yes, sir, the patrol cop said. There was something already funereal about the scene in the park. People standing around, a body on the ground, half under the bushes, a gate made of yellow tape. Who found her? I found her, a bespectacled, lean man volunteered. He'd been standing with a woman who kept pulling a dog, presumably theirs, away from the crime scene. The man took out of his wallet some ID that identified him as Anthony Thurston, a writer for the Post-Gazette. I called my wife to come for the dog, he said. Did you touch anything? Yes, I pushed the bush aside. I felt for a pulse. I felt her neck. I was sure she was dead. I called 911 and waited until an ambulance came and a police car. What about the dog? What did the dog disturb? I wrapped a leash around my hand until he had nothing more than a foot. I practically held him in my arms when I touched her. Did I do anything wrong? I'm so sorry. The man's eyes teared up and his hands made a steeple over his mouth. You did okay. Stand back, please. Everybody stand back. Christy went up to the body. A dainty foot, a pair of jeans. He also pushed aside the bush so he could see the rest of the girl. And he saw the sweet face of a beautiful child. He felt for a pulse, even though the paramedics watched him doing it. He felt her neck. A leaf from the bush fell on her face. He brushed it off gently. What a lovely child.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her latest novel, After Image. So, Kathleen, now you've spent three books with Richard Christie. And I'll say in the first one, he was obviously a very central character. He still is, but in the last two books, it feels to me like he's more of an ensemble. He kind of steps forward and steps back. And I'm just wondering, what have you learned about him over the course of the books? Has he changed much? Did you know him from the get-go, or are there things he's still surprising you with in terms of character development?
He seems to be pretty consistent to me. He's not exactly surprising me, but he's becoming more and more real. And in some ways, I think it's really funny that my agent actually said to me about one of the female characters in this book, because the women always fall in love with him, whether they're the victims of crime or people working with him or whatever. And she said to me about somebody's perception, oh, she sees he's just a man. She sees he's only a man. And I was thinking, I guess that's what I'm doing. I'm making him more and more human, even though he has these sort of paternal godlike properties throughout all of the books so far.
Yeah, there's, you know, it's in a way, the first book helps obviously orient you to him. You're introduced to him. You get a strong sense of him. But in each book, there's kind of like a new nuance that comes out about him. As you just said, paternalistic. He kind of thinks about that a little bit in this book, like why he behaves that way. Was that something you found new in this book, or is that something you always kind of knew about his character?
I think I began to see it in the second book, in Fallen, and it really gelled for me in this one, in After Image. And partly the theme of the book starts to color my perceptions too. And this one has to do with inappropriate power relationships and sexuality. So I think I was looking at that kind of thing in this book.
Another thing I was thinking about from the section that you read, as I read in your bio, you live on the north side. This book is set on the north side. And I was wondering, just in the walking into the park and thinking it through, when you write those scenes, are you doing that from your imagination and your familiarity with the landscape, or do you actually go kind of retrace steps? I'm just kind of wondering, since you're from Pittsburgh, you know Pittsburgh so well, now it's, you know, actually in your neighborhood, how you kind of manage your sense of landscape.
I do both. Sometimes I'm just imagining, but my character, Colleen, runs in the park. I don't run anymore. I used to run, but now I walk. However, I have walked in the park, and I let the park talk to me. And one of the things I noticed was a very thick clump of bushes. And I thought, you know, I'm seeing all of these homeless people lying around the park, and they've got this kind of quilt and that sort of bedspread. And if somebody were dead, you wouldn't know the difference for a while. That person would be lying in the park too, you know? So that's how this body isn't found right away. And the homeless people in the park are real to me. I saw them. I saw that clump of bushes. And also on some of my longer walks, I've been fascinated by the Park Service buildings. It's just a sort of series of brick garages, and I set a scene in there, too, that is very important in this book.
Right. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her latest novel, After Image. Kathleen, will you read a bit more for us?
Sure. I think what I'll do is go backwards and do a little bit of a passage that led me to the title of this book, After Image. I had the usual time with editors of trying a title, and they wanted a different title. I mean, that keeps happening to all the writers I know and me. And so I was struggling to find a title, and I kept saying, it's about this phrase that I'm using about something seen and then remembered in the print of the eye. And that didn't work as a title. And I happened to be telling this to one of the people at Pitt. And he said, oh, I have a great title for you. My son never used it. I gave it to him and he didn't use it. It's After Image. And so that's how the title came about. And here's the one of the sections in which After Images in someone's mind really affect them. This is the section in which the woman detective, the new rookie, Colleen Greer, is out in the park very, very early in the morning. And it's the section in which she sees but doesn't know she sees the body. I should say also that Colleen is living with a man named John, and so the reference to John here is she's with him most of the time. And the reference to him, he's her boyfriend. There were no cars moving now. It was too early to be out, still almost night. John should have said, no, don't go alone. Climb back in. He should have said, wait, you're not going without me, not at this hour. But he hadn't said any of those things. Her feet started the jog. Keys in her pocket, tissue, and that was it. Nothing to steal from her, that was for sure. She crossed the street and made her way into West Park. In the dim light, she saw bits of the colorful baggage that made bedding for the homeless men who preferred the park to the Light of Life Ministries. Usually she ran later in the morning when the men were waking, sitting up and groggily letting the day in. She chugged along past the statue of George Washington on his horse, past the path to St. Peter's. If this were Europe or even one of the small towns of her youth, there would be old women going to church now, but early morning masses were becoming a thing of the past. One man sleeping, two men sleeping, two more, one green quilt, one red something or other, two scrambled sets of rags. So colorful, like India, poverty and friendship. What was at hand to cushion and wrap the body? Use it. Rain washed these bedclothes. Sunshine dried them out. How did these people feel? To have nothing, wait for a few bucks, get your drink or your drug, whatever you needed, and experience what the rest of us miss. The grass, the earth, the birds, the sound of traffic, the sky. Well, in summer anyway, it seemed a possible way to live. She kept running. She could feel her heart rate accelerating, her body manufacturing sweat. Her thoughts turned to John. He never wanted to do anything anymore. She said last night when she got home late, we need to get away somewhere, even if only for a weekend. But he said his work schedule was going to be tight for a while. Early on, a year ago, they'd gone to Toronto for a weekend. Once he accompanied her to a wedding in Connecticut. That was about it. All those free flights he has going to waste, an unused perk. She runs. She and John look good together, her light and him dark, neither of them overly tall. They fit. She runs. There's traffic moving on North Avenue now. One homeless man sits up. Still, it's mostly quiet, peaceful, early, humid. Sweat is pouring down her face. Then a funny thing happens. Inside, in the print of her eye, she's seen something, but she doesn't know what, something important. She shakes her head to figure out what it was. She looks around, can't figure it out. It's like when she's reading and knows she sees a particular word and can't locate it again. But this is something she can't even define. She stops running. She feels dizzy. Is she overtired? Her heart plummets. What if she turns out to be weak, bad at this police work? She starts running again. Is she frightened? It's her mind playing tricks again. She turns, does her loops around sidewalks, looks up toward where Hoffman's office is. Maybe she saw Hoffman in her peripheral vision going to work. But if she did, there's no evidence of his car now. At one point, she thinks there must be a couple under a bush far to her left, for she sees what looks like a woman's foot sticking out, like something out of an Irish play, tinkers living and loving under a bush. Funny to think of women living so much on the edge of things. Keep running. Clear the head. She finishes with three laps around the pond. The ducks look at her with some interest. Then they go back to snoozing. They live a dangerous life. She's heard some of the neighborhood people steal the ducks from time to time, make dinner of them. There are a lot of poor people in the neighborhood. The park happens to be relatively clean today. No condoms. No needles. She's seen the cleanup crew some morning slowly sweeping those things out of sight. Back at John's place, she's surprised to hear his voice when she walks in the door. The phone light in the living room is lit, but as soon as she slams the door, the light goes out. He's at the top of the stairs, naked. "Where the hell did you go?" "For a run," she says. "It's not even light out." "It is now. I told you. Listen, don't yell. I'm a bit shaken." "What is it?" She climbs the steps toward him. "Something funny happened." He takes her hand. "What?" "It could have been imagination," she says. "I don't know." He puts his arms around her and holds her, a nice, tight wrestler's hold. "I'm really sweaty." "It's okay. What's wrong?" "I got the spooks in the park. I felt like I saw something in my peripheral vision, but I couldn't catch it." "What kind of thing?" "For a while, I thought maybe the guy we questioned the other night. Maybe he passed in his car going to his office, and I saw him without knowing I did. But I ran up that way to check, and nothing doing. I guess it was just the spooks." "It's hardly light enough out to see," he says. "No wonder. Come back to bed." "Do you think I'm losing it?" "No." She lies back now, trying to calm down. In the tangle of covers, these of light blue, she thinks briefly of the people living outdoors with nothing but friendship and some drug or other to keep them going. She's still got a bad case of the nerves. John had said they'd spend time this morning over at Alindo's breakfast, talking, debriefing about the picnic. She's curious about what he thought of Christy, Dolan, and the others. He puts his arms around her and hugs. Arms. His last name, Brock, is wonderfully appropriate. He uses his arms well. He's a good hugger. "Take your time," he says. "Breathe." "How much wine did I have last night?" she asks. "A couple of glasses." "It's very unsettling, very." "You're okay," he says. "Just rest up for a few minutes, and then we'll go over to Lindo's. A little food." "Or a lot," she adds. He says, "You'll feel better, different, better." She nods.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her latest novel, After Image. Kathleen, in your first book, Taken, Marina, who actually ends up marrying Richard Christie, in essence, she wasn't a detective, but she functions that way. She's got a theater background. She got kind of caught up in a kidnapping. She observes one and becomes part of the story. And now we have a female detective. She's a bit of a rookie. She's learning things. She's also very astute. She has a psychology background. And so I'm just wondering if there's anything different that you found writing a female detective, or kind of female observation from the men, or even what your interest is in these kind of female characters?
Well, I think it's always interesting to see how women who don't have physical strength might deal with danger and dangerous situations in general. But I trust the women detectives. I trusted Marina. I trust Colleen to be sensitive to things, to notice things, and to do right. They have a certain amount of patience, I think, mm-hmm. that I like writing. I appreciate that. And in fact, in my most recent book, I keep having Marina say she actually wants to join the force in a serious way. And Christy is a little worried about that. Two of them in one family, you know, that sure. Can't be a good thing. And yet she gets more and more serious about it. So who knows? I don't know whether it's going to happen or not. I'm just writing it. I let them behave.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I'm like, I wonder if, it got me calculating. I'm like, so how close to retirement is he? And would he retire? And then she joins the force. And of course, bringing in the women character also allows you to kind of deal with the issues of women in careers that are traditionally not their male focused. And so there's that kind of carving out turf between the sexes. Who can they really hold up to the job? And of course, they're very competent women.
Colleen ends up having trouble with that in this book, in the meetings that they're having with a lot of male detectives. She's paired up with McGranahan, and he keeps interrupting her and trying to answer questions that she's supposed to answer just to show his power, really, his territory. But she handles it pretty well. And Christy notices it going on, too, and he sort of defends her in the meeting.
Sure. This is going to take us in a different direction, but I was thinking about it because in the first selection you read, talking about three murders in 36 hours, and the first murder we're introduced to in the book is one that's brutal. It's very brutal. And it made me start thinking about that in dealing with that context, how you choose how much blood, how much gore that you use on the page and how much you kind of hold back. Because, of course, you want people to be intrigued. You also don't want it to be over the top. And I guess the reason I was thinking of it is because as a reader, I was really having to trust you. The same way that I feel sometimes like with filmmakers, that I want them to show me enough, but not too much. And do you think that through, or is it just something that as you're writing, it seems to work itself out?
I'm very aware of not wanting to do something that's getting to be a fashion, and that's to start with something really, really gory as a prologue, so that you don't even know who the characters are. You just know that somebody's strangling his wife or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And I find that dishonest. So I don't want to do that. But otherwise, I think I'm just going with the situation. I'm also very aware on television of things that I think are too gory or too bloody, that are gratuitous.
Sure.
Things you're being shown that you don't need to see.
But there is kind of the flip side, and I guess that's why I was thinking about it as well, that for homicide detectives, there is something that you learn about them. It's kind of their circumstance of what they have to deal with day in and day out at work. It almost becomes like a secondary character. We learn by how they react to the crime scenes, more about them, how numb they've become or how they're still impacted by it. Particularly, you've put together a rookie with some people who have been there for a while. It's something that I think is a tricky thing to deal with. I think you do it really well. And I was just curious, you know, how obviously you've thought about it quite a bit.
I have. I think that sometimes I do research. I mean, I try to do as much of it as I can. And in one case, I went to the morgue because I wanted to know what that was like and what would happen when people had to identify bodies there. It turns out it's done differently in different cities. And I learned a lot, really. But I was surprised to find out that now the person identifying never gets near the body. They use a camera. I thought that was really interesting. And I thought how horrifying it would be to want to see the person and only be able to look on a camera. And the person moving the camera has no particular sympathy
Sure.
for the person who's out in the waiting room. So that was all very interesting. But when I was there, I learned something that if I'd read it, it never would have penetrated in the same way. And that was that the smell really lingers. It stays with you for a long time after you've left. And it's a really devastating smell there. So I had Colleen experience that when she went.
Sure. And it would also show her as, you know, kind of new into this world, because my guess is people who have worked in the morgue for a long time probably don't even notice it any longer.
Right. Yeah, they don't, or they learn to breathe through the mouth.
to find ways to cope with it. Will you read a little bit more from After Image?
Sure. I thought, and I've never tried this before, I would read a little section from the prime suspects life. And this is the husband of the first murder victim, and he's just found out what's going on at the house. He's been back to the house, and the police are there and that sort of thing. And they've questioned him and released him. It's 3 a.m. Hoffman is so tired he can hardly move. When he was a child, he used to fall asleep standing up. It would come on him suddenly, like in the old movies when someone got a chloroform handkerchief over his face. His mother worried about that instant fatigue, the way he got lost, just gave up consciousness. He tries to drive home now, but sleep overtakes him. As powerful as a sleeping potion, as old and powerful as the chloroform hanky. Still downtown, he manages to pull over to a spot in front of a breakfast joint with a 222 sign in the window. Two eggs, two bacon, two pancakes, two of everything. He lets his head fall back against the headrest, hardly noticing it's uncomfortable, the angle working a pain into his neck. A second later, he is asleep. It's a little past five when a tap on the window wakes him. A uniformed policeman stands there looking nervous, perhaps nervous that the knock wouldn't rouse him, then possibly nervous that it has. "You okay, buddy?" the policeman asks. "I'm okay, waiting for breakfast. They open at 6. "You could have gone to an all-nighter, Ritter's," says the policeman. "I like this place." "I do, too. You had a rough night?" "Kinda. Do I have to move?" "Well, there's no parking here from 7 on. Morning traffic has to get through." "Oh, I'll be gone by then." "Okay," the cop raps twice on his windshield and leaves, looking relieved. David Hoffman looks at the city waking up. Way up the street, he sees in his rearview mirror is a woman, probably a hooker, getting into a car. The car moves slowly. Maybe she isn't being paid for it, maybe some innocent explanation. Everybody hooks up, one way or another. Mean people, depressed people, all kinds, ugly, horrible people get hooked up everywhere he looks. Traffic has started to appear. He becomes aware of the hum of motors around him. A homeless man carrying about 7 grocery bags of clothing, it looks like, ambles along. He probably has someone somewhere he drinks with. A bus discharges 2 people who then walk purposefully down a side street. A lone car horn toots, and a little later a few more horns, as if they've been awakened by the first, punctuate the morning. Some things he knows start crowding in on him. He weeps a little. After a while, he thinks he smells bacon. He consults his watch. Too early. Imagination, the bacon was, more in his mind than in the world. It's happened before, the way the mind works, looking for pleasure, comfort, even in the midst of despair. Oh, poor Laura. Most days he hated her for leaving him, and then for her sharp inquisitions, then for thriving without him. But today he thinks kindly of her, imagines her asking him in a gentle voice what is wrong with him, imagines himself accepting her hand on his shoulder, and then, even then, in his imagination, he's still himself, unable to tell her the things he knows, on the verge of telling her, and still unable.
Kathleen, our time has gone quickly. Thanks so much for coming to Prosody.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Amy Sutton and Ziggy Edwards. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.